plugged in. You're very welcome to this afternoon's session on financial risk management and practical methods to improve return on capital. We've got two speakers today from the Institute's Risk Management Practice Committee. They've got a presentation each, and in the interest of time, I'm not going to go through their biographies. Any of you who have a pressing need to know what John did as a child, you can come and ask him after the session.
Very, very interesting.
That speaks well for your slides, John. So John is going to speak first for about 10 to 15 minutes, followed by Zach Roberts for 10 to 15 minutes. We plan to have a similar length of time for questions afterwards. What I'd ask you to do is speak to the mic that's in the centre of the room, and as you start your question or comment, if you could just say your name and what company you're from, that would be great, and save me writing it down while you're talking. So without further ado, I'll hand over to John Evans from the Risk Management Practice Committee of the Institute of Actuaries. Thanks, John.
Okay, are we on? Yes. Okay, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to this session. First, a couple of thanks. Thanks to Martin for chairing. And thanks also to Wayne Brazel, who reviewed and gave us a bit of input on this presentation you're about to see. Having said that, just to clarify, these are Zach and myself's personal views. We're not representing the Risk Management Committee as such, or our employers. Okay, so the purpose today is to demonstrate an enterprise risk management approach to financial risk management and some of the practical steps in implementing this kind of thinking. As Martin said, we're going to talk for about 30 minutes. There is a lot to get through, so we'll have to go through pretty quickly. Having said that, Zach and I will be at the ERM stand out by reception there after this session, so we can take questions there afterwards if you'd like to come and find us. Okay, so four components to this session. I'm going to take the first two, so just basically setting the scene and giving a bit of framework about what we're doing here. Then a little bit about some practical examples of how that can be implemented. And then Zach's going to go on to look at two specific case studies around two particular risk types, namely inflation and equity. Okay, so the framework that we're putting up here is kind of divided into three chunks. And the first one's up there, so understanding your risk appetite and your risks. Pretty fundamental that you know what risks you're willing and able to take as an organisation and what risk profile you want. You also need to know what return you're going to get from each risk and the economic capital associated with that, so you can put things onto a sort of risk-reward grid and rank them. The second part we've got is understanding the risk management approaches, which really is an analysis of individual risks. So fundamentally, cost-benefit analysis of different treatments, so either maintaining risk or mitigating, transferring, or indeed increasing risks in particular areas. The third bit, and probably most importantly, is the management of the risks holistically to maximise shareholder value. Basically, the premise is that managing risks together rather than individually, you can improve returns on capital. And just a quick question before we go any further. Does anybody recognise this as a framework that they all use in their organisation or other organisations that they work with? Okay, right. I'm not sure that's good or bad, actually. Yeah. Okay, so I'm now moving on to look at how this framework can be implemented. Obviously, the purpose of this, as we've said, is to maximise or improve return on capital. And there's three basic needs there. First of all, you need to know how much capital you ought to be holding. Secondly, you need a way of allocating that and charging for the use of that capital. And thirdly, you need to align incentives of management to act in the way that's going to maximise return on capital. So these three are kind of fueled by three important tools. One, having a clear risk appetite. Secondly, having an economic capital measure and a tool to do that. And thirdly, having a shareholder value added framework. Obviously, it's important that we have some demonstrable benefits to the business of doing this, and we'll be touching on that at the end. So risk appetite, I guess the first vital thing is that you have got a risk appetite defined for the organisation, and that underpins the risk management of the organisation. I think a lot of organisations implicitly have one, but you actually need to clearly articulate it. The second thing is that that ought to be approved by the board and should be approved by the board, and it's got to basically tell us what risk we're prepared to accept in writing our business. One of the things that I've come across in doing this in practice is that there actually is a very unclear conceptual definition in lots of organisations about what they mean by risk appetite. And that comes down to something as simple as this. Well, maybe it doesn't look simple, but it is simple. It's basically deciding whether risk appetite is your willingness to take on risk, which is an outside boundary there, whether it's your ability to take on risk, so that's more like a risk-taking capacity, which is dictated by things like how much capital you've got and what risk expertise you've got. And that needs to be contrasted with the target risk appetite or risk profile that you're aiming for, which is the kind of green shape in there inside both of those two boundaries. And then, of course, you've got to monitor your actual risk profile, which is the red line, and you should have appropriate triggers in place for certain actions when those boundaries are broken. The way that you can actually express that boundary, the risk appetite boundary, comes down to a number of ways, but they can be quantitative, they can be qualitative, they can be very sort of philosophical about the types of risks that you're prepared to take. There's some examples on there around things like capital resilience, shareholder profit volatility, and that kind of thing. One really important thing is that risk appetite does permeate the whole management of the company, and you can see there a risk management framework which I've lifted from my own organisation. The bit I actually wanted to concentrate was on the top block there, which is to do with alignment of strategic plans and risk appetite. I think in the past probably risk appetite hasn't been that well defined in organisations, and it's very unclear whether strategic plans do align with it. So it's important to have plans that you can demonstrate. And in fact, the first question I think that the risk committee should be asking of any strategic plan is it within our risk appetite? Of course, that doesn't mean the risk appetite is set in stone. It can never be moved, which is a perception that I've heard. And what this is trying to emphasise is that it's a continually evolving cycle here of revisiting your appetite against those plans and vice versa. But what it does give is transparency over whether what your risk appetite is and whether you're actually changing that. So some of the issues with risk appetite, as I say, the first one is really to have this clear conceptual definition. Otherwise, you will have a lot of confusing conversations and very little buy-in to what you're doing. You need to decide which of your important dimensions that you want to include in your risk appetite, so capital, earnings, etc. And as far as possible, you want to push this risk appetite that might exist at the group level down to lines of business or the segments in which the business is managed. The closer alignment between the risk appetite that you've got and the way that the finance is managed, the better, because then there's clear ownership and transparency over which risks are being taken. Okay, I'm now moving on to economic capital, and this is the two-second version of economic capital. As many of you will probably already know, economic capital is the amount of capital you need to hold to absorb losses, and you define a time horizon and a confidence interval over which you're aiming to hold that capital. That's shown in the first diagram there on the left-hand side, the sort of classic bell curve type 99.95% point. It's kind of popular for many reasons, but mainly because it gives a sort of common currency for risk in that you can apply that kind of model to many risk types in many business units within the organisation, and gives a basis for aggregating up. But as graph 2 shows there on the right-hand side, different portfolios have very different distribution or loss distributions. So in fact, the point that you choose on, or the confidence interval that you choose, will influence quite heavily the amount of capital that each of those business lines is going to be charged for. One practical issue that you'll come across if you have to do this in practice is that there's kind of two views of economic capital. There's the external top-down kind of view of economic capital that you might get from a rating agency, and then there's the bottom-up view, which is coming out of these complex loss distribution models. The bottom-up approach requires a lot of complex modelling, obviously, and it needs data to support the parameters that you're using in it. But the difficulty comes when those two things don't align, so what do you do? Well, traditionally, what's happened in the banking world is that the economic capital from the bottom-up has been used to allocate that top-level view of how much equity you should hold. But the alternative, of course, is to recalibrate your models to a different confidence interval to align those two. But as we saw earlier, that then shifts the balance between different risk portfolios. It's time for a plug. If you want to know more about economic capital, Jennifer Lang, who's sat here in the audience, will be talking about this one tomorrow morning. So, yeah, get along to that. Okay, the third element here is the shareholder value add approach, and this is really just demonstrating a shift from a risk, from a non-risk adjusted to a risk adjusted world. So the old world, typically we've got go out and maximise profit or revenue, maybe not too much focus on the risks associated with those revenue flows, and capital managed separately and not sort of linked in with the profit side. The new world is you're going to pay for the risks that you're taking and adjusting those profits by capital charge based on the amount of capital that you're allocated as a business line, which is based on your economic capital, so reflecting the risks that you're taking. And that gives you two key metrics that you can use for managing business and adding shareholder value. Over on the right-hand side, profit after capital charge, and on the left, the return on what we call target equity or the amount of capital that you've been allocated. So how do they add shareholder value, or how do you ensure shareholder value is added? Well, anything that adds to PAC is effectively adding shareholder value. Even if that's increasing a block of business that you might have on the books that's negative in terms of PAC, any positive increase in that is a benefit. And also on the left-hand side, any business, any new business that you sell where you've got a return on target equity which is greater than the cost of capital is adding shareholder value. One of the big issues with is the cultural change from shifting the mindset from non-risk-adjusted to risk-adjusted profits. And as with any model, the key to success, really, of this type of model is incentivizing people correctly. So therefore, you need KPIs which reflect the amount of influence that different layers of management can have. And what this diagram is attempting to show is that different levels of management have different spheres of influence on either the broad strategy or going down onto the operational end of things. And you should reflect those in the KPIs, which are the sort of metrics that are down there at the bottom. I'm just going to, interest of time, I'm just going to skip on to the last slide I've got here, which is really about the benefits. As I said, there's a big cultural shift needed to make this succeed. But I think what that gives is a complete refocusing of people's minds in terms of risk management becomes not a downside protection problem, but it's an upside optimization issue. So the old world of transactional risk is bad to a sort of portfolio risk optimization is the main benefit that you want to get out of this. But also it leads to a much better understanding of the business lines about the risks that they're running, the tolerances to those risks, and capital and its drivers. So there's a number of other benefits that come out there that I've listed down there, which are, you know, all important stuff, but in the interest of time at that point, I'll hand over to Zach.
Okay, thank you, John. Being after lunch and everyone being very sleepy, I'm going to make this a bit interactive, so be ready to put your hand up. And also, as you'll see once we get into my content, there's a reason John did the first half being the more complicated part, and I'm doing this half. Okay. I just sort of put this up because what I'm going to cover now is two examples of how it is that once we think about risk holistically and think about it under the type of framework John explained, you can actually make a real difference quite easily. Okay? And you don't necessarily have to have all the things in place that John mentioned to actually be able to start making a difference. Okay? So to start with, we're going to go through an example that looks at inflation, and then we'll move on to an equity one. Oops. Okay, I've got one more page here, so I'll just tell you what it says. Everyone's got to put themselves in the position. Assume that you are the risk manager for an institution that has inflation-linked liabilities. Now, they can be disability income payments, they can be inflation-linked annuities, they can be long-tail general insurance, they can be defined benefit super, whatever is easiest for you to think about. But let's just say that you have these inflation-linked liabilities, they go out for about 10, 15 years, and of your liabilities, half of them are linked to inflation, the other half aren't. Okay, you all with me? Okay, what can you do about your inflation exposure? We've got up here an example of an inflation swap. Okay, this is quite simple. That all that happens is you look at your uninflated projected liability stream and you enter an agreement whereby you pay to a swap provider that income stream increased every year at the inflation swap price. Okay, and in this example, in late December, that was 1.8%. What you receive is your uninflated liability stream increased at actual inflation. Okay, so it's 100% hedge of your inflation risk. Okay. Now, most people, when they're doing their pricing, use a long-term inflation assumption of about 3%. Yep, I'm seeing nods in there. That's good. So here's our first show of hands. If you're in charge of this, would you enter a swap whereby you paid away 1.8% and received inflation? No one. Wow. That's good. Would you reinsure your claims if you could do it at 60% of the claims assumption that you assumed in your pricing? Surely there's some of you or the reinsurers that go broke. Yes, hands up so I can see them. Would you do that? So the question is, your inflation assumption is just another component of your claims cost. Why would you reinsure one at 60% of your expected claims cost, but not the other one at 60% of your expected claims cost? Can anyone give me some thoughts on that one? No. Okay, let's go back a bit earlier in time to mid last year when everyone was still worried about inflation. And it would have actually cost you over 4% to remove your inflation risk. So the question again, and I'm not even going to bother asking this time because if no one would pay 1.8%, I'm assuming no one in the room would pay 4.1%. Okay. Okay then. Instead, would you choose to receive 4.1% and pay away inflation? Hands up. Who would do that? Say, well, I think... Right. Someone think outside the square. Right. Basically, what you're doing there is that half of your book that's not inflation linked, You're making it inflation-linked, but you're doing it at an inflation pricing assumption of 4.1%, not 3%, 4.1%. Would you increase your inflation pricing assumption from 3 to 3.55 if you could guarantee it wouldn't impact your sales? Would you charge more for your policies if it wouldn't impact your sales? Yes? It's good to see some people awake. That's what you're doing if you enter the other side of the inflation swap. On average, you end up with the money that you're receiving on average across your whole portfolio for inflation is 3.55%. It's the 3% for the inflation liabilities you sold and 4.1 for the swap you implemented to make the other liabilities inflation linked. Yeah? So it's all about thinking, you know, big picture, back to first principles. So summing up that example, you're currently taking on inflation risk at 3% through your pricing assumptions. You're holding capital behind that because it is a risk, and if you expect inflation to be 3%, then that's a zero return on that capital. Zero. Okay. So what should you do? Look at managing that risk. Actuaries always talk a lot about managing risk. I think we're actually pretty poor at it. You know, we're very good at measuring risk. We're very good at quantifying risk and holding capital against risk. We're not actually very good at managing risk. Okay. I have to be controversial. So look at what's the cost of managing that risk. Not just look at it once, look at it frequently because it changes. Compare that cost to the return on capital you're getting from that risk compared to how much would it cost you to manage that, free up that capital and deploy it elsewhere in your business. What return on capital would you get from it there? And as I would say, manage inflation risk if it increases the return on capital of your business, whether that means decreasing your inflation risk or increasing it. Okay. Another way of sort of thinking about it is let's assume you had no inflation risk. And from first principles, you were saying, how much inflation risk do I want? I'd be very surprised if you came up with the number that you just happened to have. Okay. Yet by having the amount you've got and choosing not to manage it, that's effectively what you're doing. Okay. Any questions before we move on to the next? Oh, we'll do questions at the end. I won't be much longer. Yes? So I'll repeat it, sorry. The main question is about, are you glossing over the counterparty risk that you get from the inflation swap provider? I mean, there are second-order issues in that under a standard swap, you would have daily posting of collaterals against the margin. So, yes, you may be exposing yourself to the one day's move on inflation if the counterparty fails to post collateral on that day. Are there any insurers here or super funds or anyone who think they don't have the expertise to handle a swap? I don't expect hands to go up this time, or someone is watching. We'll get back to it anyway. Now we're going to move to equity risk, and we're going to say this time, doesn't matter what company you're in, you are now managing assets. You are head of strategic asset allocation. You're reviewing your exposure to different risk premia or asset classes. You want to retain some exposure to the equity risk premium, but you want to reduce the downside. It's starting to look a bit risky at the moment. Okay. Sort of equity protection 101 buy a put option. We've got some pricing here from, what is it, late November. Without going into the detail due to time, expensive. Okay. There are things you can do to decrease the cost of protection. There are many, many, many things you can do, but they all involve taking on more risk of some type. Okay, now that, you know, you could look and find a risk that you're happy to take on, but they all involve taking risk of some type. Okay, that's just sort of a generic point. An interesting one down the bottom here is the reason equity protection is very expensive is that everyone's scared implied volatility has gone very high. Okay, if you want to, for example, you could buy a put option where the price you pay depends on actual volatility over the term of the put option. It's calculated in arrears at the end based on actual volatility. Okay. Now, there is the risk there that if you had have done this a year ago, you would have been paying a hell of a lot for actual volatility. So I'm saying. But from an actuarial point of view, you would have a lower expected cost of protection because no actuarial model would have ever expected the volatility we got in the last year. Okay. So there are things that can be done. It's just a matter of what extra risks you're willing to take on. What I wanted to sort of talk about instead is let's go back to first principles again and say, okay, we're after the equity risk premium here. Is there a better way of getting that than holding equities and buying protection? Okay, if we're after the equity risk premium with some type of protection. And what I've got here is, what if instead we said, well, instead of holding equities, let's sell equity volatility. Okay. You can sell equity volatility through quite standard swaps, again, just a variance swap, okay, where the example down the bottom here, there is a term to a variance swap, say 5 years. I'll use 5 years in the example later on. There is a price right now, and at the end of 5 years, you measure actual variance over 5 years. And if it's above that price, then the seller of a variance swap would have to pay something. If it's below, you receive something. How much do you pay and receive? That's the notional of the variance swap. Okay, it's reasonably simple. Here, the red squiggly line is 5 year actual volatility of the S&P 500. So, you know, at the very start there, it's the 5 years up until, I don't know when that is, early 30s. Okay, so it was around 40%. It's come down, and since about 1940, it hasn't been above 25%. Okay, and the lines I have there are the percentiles of that distribution. So time for the show of hands again. Who would sell volatility at, say, the green line? Okay, good to see. So basically, who would enter into a contract that says, in 5 years' time, I will make money if actual volatility over the next 5 years is lower than about 42%. Now, to give you an idea, 42% is about 2.5% every day for 5 years. So, okay, a few more hands. Thank you. Is it good? What about the purple line, the next one down? So it's the 95th percentile. Yeah? And thinking in the back of your heads, is this a safer thing than actually owning equities? Selling volatility at this level. What about the 75th percentile, 25? You know, you wouldn't have lost money on that strategy since 1941. Okay, I've got a few, not as many. November 2008, you could sell 5 year S&P 500 equity volatility at 40%. Okay. So that's selling a mean reverting asset at its 97th percentile. It's just basic economics or basic investing, but instead of buy low, sell high, we sell high, buy low later. What I have here is very, very roughly, over that same time period from the start, looking at 5 year investments, so one that starts on one day and finishes in 5 years' time, one that starts a day later, finishes in 5 years' time. On the vertical axis, that's your return on equities, if you had have made a 5 year equity investment per annum return. Now, let's not get too worried about the exact numbers. There's no dividends in any of this. It's just price. But you can see 80% of the time, well, okay, let's explain the whole graph first. Across this way is your return if you had have sold 5 year volatility at 40%. Okay, now it's not a per annum return because there's no such thing. You know, it depends on how much you make, depends on how much volatility was. And it's pretty silly to think of a return on investment because there is no initial investment. It's just a contract. You know, credit risk is addressed through the fact that there will be margining on the contract, but there is no upfront investment. Okay, so all that is shown on the axis really is what was 5 year actual volatility compared to 40%. So if 5 year volatility was actually 30%, then that's going to show up as a 10% here because you've made 10 volatility points. Okay. So what this graph is telling us is that most of the time, 80% of the time, both strategies made us money. Either holding equities or selling volatility at 40% would have made us money. Bottom left is the time when both of those strategies would have lost us money. Okay? There are some times when both would have lost us money, although, as you can see, the blue is a lot further down the loss scale than it is across the scale. So holding equities probably would have lost us more. The bits that sort of the reason I put this graph up here is for the other two corners. The bottom right are the percentage of scenarios when we would have lost money by holding equities, but made money through selling volatility. Okay? Almost one fifth. Okay? Compared to the top left, which is the other way around, when we would have lost on the volatility but made money on the equities, hasn't happened yet. Okay? Not to say it wouldn't, just hasn't happened yet. So in summarising all that, if we return back to the principles, the risk management principles we were talking about, if our aim is to maintain exposure to the equity risk premium with reduced downside, I think we should be looking from first principles and say, well, what's the best way we can do that? Yeah. Is it consider equities and put options, or consider other ways of gaining access to the same returns driven by the equity risk premium, but in a way which has a better sort of risk-reward profile. So, after all of that, now we'll show hands. Who thinks that selling volatility at 40% is something worth considering as an alternative to owning equities? See, I told you we'd get most of you putting your hands up. That's about it, actually. I don't have questions. I think that's it, yep.
Okay, so I might throw it open to the floor for questions or comments. If I could ask you, as I mentioned, to come to the microphone in the middle of the floor and say your name before you make your comments so we know who you are.
Otherwise, I'll ask more questions.
Go on, Zach, Mike Thornton. Look, I think the show of hands at the beginning was kind of interesting because there were kind of a few sort of muted hands in the air, which I think tells me, like my own company, that I think we'd like to think we were kind of using these kind of frameworks, but in practice it's maybe a bit clunky and slow and maybe not as holistic. It's a bit more piecemeal, if you like. I guess could you comment on sort of what you see across the industry and how kind of embedded this sort of framework is? Is in practice?
Sure, I think I don't think it's embedded that well. I think people, as I might have alluded to earlier, have tended to focus on understanding the risks, working out what the maximum possible loss is in the 99.9th percentile scenario and holding that much capital, instead of saying, how can I, risk by risk, is it worth reducing a risk? Is it worth increasing a risk? Given that the stated goal of most companies is to improve return on capital, which is just an actuarial way of saying return on risk. But I don't think it's very well embedded at all. I'd be interested to see if anyone else has other views. By the way, interestingly, if you had have sold equity volatility at 40% in November, it's trading now down at the low 30s, so you would have made quite a bit of money since then.
I've got one question myself, probably more for you, John, because I don't like you. a lot of press and comment about risk appetite talks about boards should approve this, and I definitely agree that it's sufficiently important that it needs to be a very senior thing, but one area that I'm not so clear on is whether boards actually want to make statements about here is the likelihood I deem acceptable for the company going bust. In my experience, not easy to get boards to sign off on things that are significantly less personal and dangerous sounding than that. So it's whether boards are ever going to actively ask management to come to them with statements of risk appetite that they can then approve. So otherwise, I'm not sure it's ever going to actually happen.
probably timed that a bit wrong, because if you ask me in about 4 weeks when I've done a session with the CBA board, I'll let you know. but I think there is a... I think people are willing to sign off on risk appetite statements, and if you ask the chairman of any risk committee, a board risk committee, they're probably moments sort of saying, God, we really need to express what our appetite is. And certainly the messages you get from the business lines is, you know, we need guidance as to what we can do and what we can't do. So I think everyone is now pulling in the same direction. I think historically you might be right that people were reluctant to write down, you know, this is what we stand for, and this is the risk appetite that we're prepared to take, because it put up barriers to, you know, grey some of the more difficult decisions, if you like. But I think the important thing that comes out of this, as I said in the talk, is that some transparency over what your appetite is, and particularly when you're moving away from what it is. And that's fair enough. You can do that consciously, but just don't do it, you know, subconsciously.
I'll ask a question if no one's got one. Yeah. It was going to be an easy one, Adam.
Adam Follington. I was just thinking about the inflation slides you put up, particularly there. What kind of transaction costs? So I'm thinking particularly, say, an income protection, open claims, reserving portfolio. What kind of transaction costs are involved in, say, do you think... putting together some kind of inflation hedge like you talked about?
Zero. I mean, there's your lawyers, if you need lawyers to look at a swap or something, but basically any costs are inbuilt into the number 1.8 or the number 4.1. And there's no costs over and above that.
Jennifer Lang, since you've got the inflation one, it's more a comment than a question. The thing that occurred to me looking at that is one of the things we discuss when we talk about risk appetite is what kind of risks are we actually interested in, not just how much risk. And for our general insurance company, we're basically not interested in market risk at all. We basically want to get rid of everything. So we're only really interested in one side of those two types of inflation swap. We'll reduce it to say it's gone away, but there's no way we can see the other side, which I just thought was an interesting reflection on how that whole, you know, risk appetite works. Some risks are things that aren't outside the boundary of our company.
Yeah, so you've sort of made a sort of decision effectively to say we're going to target maximum return on capital on risk, but only limit ourselves to these risks. Yeah, and then that's a, you know, business decision you can make.
Yeah, and one of the qualitative things that should be in a risk appetite statement is specifically what risk do we have a zero tolerance for.
I'd make a comment on the sort of what I might call the actuarial standard risk management approach, which, you know, as I sort of said before, is to understand the risks, hold capital against it. And I'm wondering if, you know, one of the reasons that there's less inclination to actively manage risks is that, on average, over the long term, you may be expected that that would cost you money. And so there's this, like, whole long-term view, actuarial assumptions, said, well, on average, over the long term, we're better off holding capital. We've got a balance sheet. We've got capital. Let's just hold capital and let's run the risks. And, you know, that's a valid way of looking at things. But I think what some people miss, and maybe if anyone's got any comments on this, is that if you take that risk management approach, you better realise that every now and again you're in for a lot of pain, you know, as we've just seen. And that's the bad year that goes along with the good 20 years. But that will happen. And you sort of maybe want to be thinking, what's our pain threshold? What's the point at which we say, okay, enough's enough? Or are we just really want to say, well, our pockets are as deep as deep can be?
Can I just make one comment as somebody who's done something in this area? There's an interesting question about costs earlier. I think whilst you're right, an inflation swap on the one hand doesn't cost you anything. It took us about 2 years to develop a proposal and get it implemented from end to end. So there is certainly a significant management overhead in terms of getting buy-in from executive teams doing the cost-benefit analysis. I think the trick to this, I think, is identifying the opportunity. Because there was a long period of time where we were looking at a transaction of this order where the cost was 4.1% and was significantly higher than our best estimate assumption. But over the throughout that two-year process, that cost came crashing down. So we just happened to be in the right place at the right time. But I think identifying the opportunity, but building the case is kind of essential, because then you're well placed to be able to take advantage of those opportunities when the price is right. And I agree with you. I think the old actuarial approach of holding capital against these risks is fine, but you know, if you can look for an opportunity to de-risk and free up your capital, there's got to be merit in there.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely agree. One of the things that I hear a lot of defined benefit pension plans say now is like, oh, it would be great to de-risk our pension plan, but unfortunately we don't have the solvency to do it right now. We'll have to wait until we get back to where we were 2 years ago. But if you actually look risk by risk and say, well, for a defined benefit pension plan, if you're not actually paying out pensions, if all you've got is basically a wage-linked lump sum at retirement as your single biggest liability, then your single biggest risk is inflation. And you've never seen a better time to hedge inflation risk. You don't have to wait till you've got a solvency to do it. In fact, if you do wait, the price will be worse.
Probably time for one last question, John.
I was going to offer a comment. And, you know, if you're holding the capital, that's a cost. Think of it, the capital is money borrowed. You have to pay for that. So if you're in product development, rate making on general insurance side, whatever, I mean, that's something you have to consider. And so if your company has to hold more capital, chances are their returns are going to be lower and they're going to be less competitive with other industries.
Thank you.
Okay, well, we might wrap it up there. Thank you, Zach, and thank you, John, for your contributions. You both get a bottle of wine and I don't. But I've asked you all to join with me and thank John and Zach for their presentation today.